But this isn't really the kind of poem that you have to like poetry to get. So it's more like a string of limericks. And limericks, as you may know, are the low bar in the world of poetry. So anyway. It was six men of Indostan to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. So now you basically have the height of the bar, poetry-wise. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Ho! What have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me, 'tis mighty clear this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out his eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "E'en the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can. This marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope than, seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right, and all were in the wrong. And in this particular version of this poem, there's in this bold-faced, single word, moral, just so you know, you're switching out of the poem. But we stay with the same pentameter, more or less. "So oft in theologic wars, the disputants, I ween, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate about an elephant not one of them has seen." That is John Godfrey Saxe's late 1800s version of a famous Indian legend about the blind men and the elephant. And on the website that I took it from, it had this picture with it, which I thought we would just leave there as a companion. Sort of the, once again, an adjustment of the art bar from Rublev's Trinity to this. Poems like songs sometimes have a way of helping us to see or acknowledge things that we might otherwise be resistant to. They kind of come in the side door. Art does generally. And whether we want to deign to call this poem art or not, we'll just leave that alone. Because in this case, the poem is fairly heavy-handed. It's not particularly oblique. That wouldn't be particularly oblique even without the moral announcement at the end and the last stanza, you know. But that sort of settled it. But still, I think there's a way that it can help us to take a little bit of an, oh yeah, that's right, look at something that we might otherwise just kind of stiff-arm, you know, and just push away without giving consideration to. It does make rather obvious the ridiculousness of making categoric claims about having everything figured out. And it does also suggest that a better stance might be to, with some humility, continue when we're exploring to ask for both the retention of that spirit of humility and also for some broader perspective from a different vantage point in our exploration, for guidance. And so what I want us to do before we kind of go any further is take a minute or so to do just that. And we're going to do that in silence for a couple of reasons. One is because I don't need to articulate your invitation for guidance. You need to articulate your invitation for guidance. That's a thing that comes from where we are as individuals. But the fact that we're going to choose to do it together in this space, in a shared time, also, I think, says something about our shared commitment to being led and to being open-minded, open-hearted, and open-lived when it comes to being on a quest to know God. So we're going to take a moment to be silent and invite God to guide us. I think that in a busy, noisy world, silence is a gift. I'm also a dad with four kids, and I can remember hearing each of them make noise for the first time, which I suppose is just a long way around of saying that the noises of life are also a gift. And in this space, with our little people back with us, I want to remind us as a community that their sounds are the sounds of life. Not the sounds of interruption. All right? Just so we know the perspective that that we strive to hold together. If you're a parent, you'll understand that in a different way than if you're not, of course. But they're not part of our community. They're just the youngest part of our community. I often build in what I do in the morning on the email piece that I send out each week, in terms of theme or starting point. And so just a little soft poll. How many of you get that email? You're not going to be accosted if you don't put up your hand. But I am curious to know. Okay. All right. And as usual, I'm tempted to ask how many of you read it, and I won't. All I'm going to tell you is that if you don't read it, you're going to be lost for the next half hour. Okay? No, that's not true. But anyway, it's tempting, isn't it? Just to write something that leaves everyone who didn't read it completely out in the cold. I'd be so manipulative, and it's so unbelievably tempting. Anyway, I won't do that, at least not on purpose. What I talked about in that piece is what it's like to be the owner of a PC, and how much of my life is spent doing other things while my computer reboots. It's kind of like going to the doctor's office. Like, eventually, you figure out how important it is to have a good book on the go. You know, so you can get some other things done while you're waiting. And for all the negative aspects of reboots in the life of a PC person, rebooting often does tend to solve the presenting problem, to the point where IT managers in PC environments typically broadcast the information that you shouldn't contact them if you haven't tried it first. So there's something to this. It does tend to produce, more often than not, the desired result, which is, oh, look, it's working again, right? And what I do, I say all of that not to just kind of because I have nothing else to say and I needed some filler, but because I actually want to frame the next few Sunday mornings with a couple of ideas about the biblical story that build on that necessity. You ever wonder why the Bible often has different versions of the same story, of the same events? You ever wonder about the way that the beliefs of the characters in the biblical stories sometimes changes significantly over the course of a story? Or the way that God behaves and the way that God's behavior or motivation seems to change over the course of the story and what that might mean? The way that God seems to kind of morph as the book unfolds? Well, for the purposes of the next few Sunday mornings that I'm responsible for, at any rate, I want to use the language for those kind of moments in the Bible of reboot. I want to think of those moments as reboots. And I want us to look this morning just to kind of establish, I suppose, the idea, generally. I want us to look at a very much a pre-power reboot this morning, a really ancient reboot. This is a story about a pair of biblical narratives that are so old that we don't know how old they are. There are stories about God and humanity that are ancient enough that the first of them actually predates the idea of God being personal and knowable. And we, in contemporary Christendom, we rather cherish the idea that God is personal and knowable. That's kind of essential to our belief, generally speaking. But here we have a biblical story that predates that understanding of the nature of God. And that's kind of intriguing in itself, that our sacred text would include that. I find it not just intriguing, I also find it very, very hopeful that the Bible contains descriptions of God that I would find archaic as a 21st century human. It also contains descriptions of God, sometimes directly, but more often in story, that feel to me like just these soft, safe places, you know? They feel to me like the kind of descriptions that I can just fall into and go, oh, yeah, there, I'm home. That's lovely. And it also contains descriptions of God and the nature and character and actions of God that are as far out to me, as distant from my reality as the concrete notion of time travel. Like, they just... kind of interesting, but bizarre. Those together, that kind of admixture of descriptions, those are the kind of ideas that reboot the things that comprise faith for me. That's the kind of mixture of things that tend to reboot my understanding, what happens in my head, my lived life, my embodied actions, my faith, my belief. And I'm gonna propose something to you this morning that may or may not sit well. I'm not concerned if it doesn't. In fact, I think in a lot of ways when we show up in church, we're kind of wasting our time if everything we encounter sits well. On the other hand, I don't know how many of you caught the news story this past week about the grenade storage facility that blew itself to smithereens, took a number of people with it. An explosion which was triggered by an accidentally dropped grenade. I guess the odds of never dropping one in a facility that's full of them are a little slim, but still, it's a tragedy. All that to say, I'm actually, when I do something like this, I know that in some people's lives, I'm grenade lobbing, not grenade dropping. And I'm not doing it blithely, and I'm not doing it to cause trauma. I'm doing it because I think it's what is there in the story. But what I want to say is that I don't presuppose, as a pastor in this community or as a teacher in this community, that my perspective on a certain part of the sacred text is a shared perspective. And so if any particular perspective you encounter in this community kind of shakes something around, don't be distressed about that. The intent of the shaking is not to rattle us all into the same little compressed, we are all alike space. Unless you understand that space to be the space in which we have in common a determined quest for God, then I would be so pleased if we would all be shaken into that shared space. All right. I think the Bible starts with a reboot. I think the Bible actually starts with something that feels more like a false start followed by a restart. And I think there's enough qualifiers in there. I'm going to keep going. This is probably one of those situations in the sacred text where the time between trying to make it work with version 1 and trying to make it work with version 2 was chronologically pretty long. I'm not going to even pretend to try to define it more than that. We just don't have what we need to do that. And it would probably be futile in the end anyway. Basically, the Bible starts, as many of us, if we grew up with the Bible, know, with two different versions of the creation story. And they're like end to end. And they are clearly version 1 and version 2. They just plain flat out aren't the same. Version 1, of course, starts at Genesis 1:1, goes to Genesis 2:3, and the first version of the creation story is the one in which we get this idea of 7 days. That's the version of the story that gives us that shape of the narrative. Day 1, we get heavens, earth, light, day and night. Day 2, we get this curious image of the dome of the sky and the dome of the waters below the sky. It's a very interesting physical idea. Day 3, we get dry land and vegetation. Day 4, stars, moon, sun. Day 5, water, creatures, and birds. Day 6, land animals and humankind, both male and female in version 1. And intriguingly, in version 1, the number of humans is not specified. It's also interesting that in version 1, God gives to people, and this is Genesis 1:29, every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in it, every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And then the seventh day, God rests. It's interesting that on day 6, when God gives the unspecified creatures that we call humanity all their food, there are no prohibitions. In version 1, you can eat whatever you want. Version 2 is Genesis 2, 4 to 25. Some intriguing differences. Individual days are not specified in version 2. The sequence is also different. Starts with the earth and heavens. There's no rain yet, but in that period of this version of the story, a spring wells up and waters the ground. And then from dust, man is created, but not woman yet. And the Garden of Eden is then present in the sequence, and man is put there. The garden includes the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God tells man to till and keep the Garden of Eden, but not to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's important in this sequence of the narrative to notice that the woman isn't in the scene yet. Man is still alone. And God notices that man is alone and wants to find him a helper and a partner. So first he creates all the animals and the birds, and man names them all. But there's still no helper or partner for man. God makes man fall asleep, pulls out a rib, makes woman, and then that's followed in the narrative sequence by the story of original sin. Well, there are a couple of things that are worth noting here. First of all, in the first version, all of creation is good. Very important establishing idea in the narrative arc of the whole story, and we've talked about that around here quite a lot. In the second story, the Garden of Eden could be understood not simply as a place of relaxed enjoyment, but also as a place of work. This is a bit of a nuanced thing here, because that doesn't necessarily make work bad, but it is a different picture than in version 1. It is a place of work. Adam and Eve are gardeners. It's also a place where, unlike in the first story, something is considered off-limits. In the second version of the story, God tells man that if he eats of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he will die that day. And that's not what happens, but that's what the text has God saying. There's also a curious little justice issue here. The woman isn't even present in the second version of the story when the prohibition about eating is originally stated, but she still gets punished for violating it. Now, as the story sequence goes, it seems that she would have been aware of the restriction, but there are lots of other issues in there. I'm not going to belabor the point. What's intriguing to me at the center of those differences is that the concept of the knowledge of good and evil is related in the shape of the story to the concept of wisdom, and wisdom is defined by the story as a divine characteristic, not a human characteristic. So when the characters in the garden are told that if they eat of this tree, they're going to gain the knowledge of good and evil, they're moving into, as the story tells it, they're moving into a divine or godlike space. But this is going to cause a problem if they do it. They shouldn't do it because it's wrong to do. So in other words, we're presented with this idea that knowing good from evil is a God-like kind of knowing. It's something God has, but humans don't. And it is presented to us in this pair of narratives as something that is problematic for humans to have. I don't know how you grew up, but I grew up being taught that knowing right from wrong, good from evil, was rather helpful and important and good. A world filled with people without this knowledge. Well, let her run. It's not a happy picture, right? We call that kind of a view of the world a pathology of one kind or another, don't we? Interesting, though, that I think all of us would say that it's true to our experience that perceiving the world through a moral lens, looking at the world with an understanding that there is something that is right and there is something that is wrong, makes life harder. It actually does make life more painful. The problem with that idea in version one of the first story in our Bible, in our sacred text, is that the original humans are presented in that story as amoral. They don't know good from evil. They can't tell good from evil. Because otherwise there's no sequence to the story. If they could already tell good from evil, how is it problematic that if they eat from the tree, they're going to be able to tell good from evil? They're presented to us in the narrative as people without this capacity to know good from evil. And yet they are held morally accountable and are punished when they engage with that capacity. That's kind of interesting. And kind of a thing that makes you go, hmm. Without the knowledge of good and evil, another way to pose the same question, without the knowledge of good and evil, how would the characters in the story have known that it was bad or wrong to disobey God in the first place? They don't have the capacity in version one. The very idea that they would know this and be responsible for it is predicated on them possessing a moral framework that they are said to not possess. And it seems a little bit duplicit of God, don't you think, to create beings without a moral framework and then to punish them harshly for doing what is wrong. But there you go. So what to do? Because this is a life-guiding text for us if we walk in the way of Christendom. These days, this is our sacred text. And here are the first two stories, version one and version two. So what do we make of the dilemmas? Because they're there. Well, there's a few different possibilities. One is that this pair of stories shouldn't be read morally at all. Maybe, at the heart of it, these are not stories about punishment for disobedience. Maybe God is trying to say, if you eat of this tree, everything will change, and you might not like it. Maybe God is saying, if you gain the knowledge to tell right from wrong, if you gain a moral lens for the universe, you are going to find your life complicated and challenged and troubled by that lens. Eventually, in this story, what happens is they do eat, and sure enough, everything changes, at which point God says, so now you have this new, harder existence. Perhaps under this sort of an existence, you don't actually want to live forever anymore. And then closes off access to the tree of endless life as an act of compassion. It rather does bring up for reconsideration the idea of original sin, which is the most common interpretation of the second creation story. And one way to articulate that possible shift is to consider that the concept of original sin is not so much due to moral disobedience present in us from the beginning, because that flies in the face of version one, in which we are brought into the world amoral, without the knowledge of good and evil. But rather, it would be better taken to express the writer's intent to help us understand the essential pain that is inherent in moral awareness. That if we have the knowledge of right and wrong, if we can discern what is good and what is not good, it's going to hurt. It's going to be hard. It's not that the characters, under this understanding, it's not that the characters in the story have done anything wrong, it's that they have become aware of right and wrong. And that simply makes life painful and difficult. That's one possibility. I'm a bit of a Coburn fan, and saw him in concert the last time he was through. As a bass player, it took me like 3 songs to get over the fact that he didn't have a bass player with him. But once I did that, I really enjoyed the concert. And he told a story behind one of his songs. I've always enjoyed the song. I've been intrigued by the particular verse that he was talking about. And the story, as he told it, was that he started out as a music student at Berkeley in Boston, dropped out after, he can't remember how long, 3 or 4 semesters. He didn't stay. He didn't graduate, which doesn't seem to have negatively affected his ability to make music all that much. Anyway, so while he was there as a student, young guy, 19 years old, he meets this guy, fellow student, friend of a roommate, who invites him to take a summer job with him running guns to Cuba. A little revolutionary. Berkeley seems like the right place somehow. And as Coburn tells the story, he says, you know, I actually found the offer kind of interesting. He says, as a 19-year-old, I really didn't have any grasp on the moral implications of what I'd be doing. I just thought it sounded, you know, kind of exciting to be a gun smuggler. And then when he got to know the guy a little better, he found out that what the guy actually wanted him to do, what the guy wanted Coburn to do, was actually serve as a human shield for him while he ran guns to Cuba. At which point, Bruce declined the job. But many years later, he wrote a song. The song's called See You Tomorrow. And the opening pair of stanzas goes like this. It's about that story. Met a mercenary once, pushing lethal steel. Wanted me to watch his back while he did his deal. He must have been a loser, or he wouldn't have looked to me. But I have to say, I like the thought of living that guilt-free. Now that's intriguing. Coburn is, among other things, a guy with a pretty thoughtful and recognizably Christian spirituality. And one of the things that he's doing in this song is he's obliquely commenting on this idea that understanding the world in moral terms makes it more complex and more difficult and more painful to live in. I kind of like the thought of living that guilt-free. Like, what kind of a moral framework does it take to invite somebody to watch your back so you can smuggle guns and just not really be concerned about the implications of that invitation? Does that sound liberating or just heinous? It's pretty commonly acknowledged that the second creation account is quite a bit younger, closer to us, chronologically, than the first one. Maybe, as the moral philosophy of humanity became more complex, the creation story needed, and got, a reboot. Could that be? Or maybe we're looking at an accounting of the shifts in how human society was organized. Basically, we're looking at the narrative version of the move from a hunter-gatherer society to an agrarian society. It's interesting to note that in version 1, God more or less plants everything. The world is like this untilled place. So all the trees and shrubs are there. God just gives them to man for his food. But in version 2 of the story, we're told that, and this is the particular translation of Genesis 2, 4, and following, that, quote, no shrub had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had yet sprung up. And then this explanation, for the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one to work the ground. Another translation says nothing had sprouted yet because, quote, a man there is not to serve the ground. Hunter-gatherers don't serve the ground. Farmers serve the ground. Agrarian people and societies serve the ground. It's interesting that in story 2, God makes man from the dust of the earth. He sets him in the garden to serve it and to keep it. In story one, the earth is just completely open, untilled landscape. There's no geographic references in story one. There's no names of places, no names of rivers, no names of boundaries. Those things are there in story two, all of them. And they're given to us in the story in a way that suggests that they would have been commonly known. They would have been held in common by the society into which the story was offered. And we also have the movement and understanding of the nature of God. So here God morphs between these two stories within one chapter of one another. We have this change in the movement of the understanding of God from simply that, God, in story one, to Jehovah in story two. We don't have the time to get into it this morning, but Jehovah God is a recognizably Hebrew concept of God. But of course, at the time when version one is given to humanity, there are no Hebrews. That's down the road quite a ways. Yeah. It's very intriguing to me that in terms of what we know about the unfolding of human society, that version one's idea of the nature of God is much more consistent, deeply consistent, with what we would now think of as an Indo-European idea about God, much less specific, much more broad, much less defined, than version two, which is recognizably a Hebrew concept of God. And if we keep chasing this one down in Genesis, what we find, because we come to the flood story right away, what we find is this understanding of the nature of God keeps unfolding. And in the early versions of the story, the way that God relates to humanity is very different than in the later versions of the story. In the early versions of the story, if we are thinking of this in terms of human society, if we think about hunter-gatherer culture, which to the best of our knowledge was a pantheistic culture, lots of gods. If we understand version one perhaps to be offered into that human society, it's very intriguing that the names for humanity in version one are things like sons of God, fallen ones, daughters of man, man in the earth. And by the time we get to Genesis 6, and we get to this more agrarian concept of Jehovah God, of a personal knowable God, divine being, if we kind of keep unfolding that through the story of the Hebrew people, we actually end up with the idea that God's a chooser of people and that the Hebrews are the chosen people. And so the way God behaves with humanity shifts a great deal in a very small amount of text. There's a lot of rebooting going on in there. And thence into the remainder of Genesis, which is basically a catalog of land disputes and intertribal warfare and semi-nomadic wandering around that culminates in the establishment of the Hebrews as a distinct nation with a God-given homeland, an idea that's still causing the occasional uproar in the world. Now, that might seem like a lot for one pass, one Sunday morning. But I got to tell you guys, it just barely scratches the surface. And we're not going to go back in. This is not going to be another one of those series where Tim can't get unstuck from the first two chapters of Genesis, I promise. But it barely scratches the surface of what's going on in there. And to me, that is fascinating and that is inspiring, because when I come to the Bible, I want to be able to come to that text as one who comes with humility and respect to an inspired, God-given text and say, this book is one of the ways that God speaks to me and to us. This is God revealed. This is not the only way God is revealed, but this is God revealed. What happens to that search if we regard our sacred text as full from the beginning with the kind of reboots that point to something? And what if we think of the reboots as pointing more than anything else to God's enduring commitment to being present in approachable ways to all of humanity through all of history? What happens then? What happens to the possibilities then? What happens to being a 21st century seeker for God then? What happens to the easy dismissal that we can summon by saying that is an archaic belief? That is an archaic understanding of God. That particular text, that particular truth, that particular story no longer applies. It only applies to the culture into which it was offered. What happens to that objection? What kind of trajectory comes from a sacred text that is willing to reboot itself as humanity unfolds so that God continues to be knowable? What happens beyond the paper boundary, the physical boundary of that text? What happens when you're a 21st century person seeking for God, but you don't have any 21st century written narratives in the canon of your sacred book? Well, if what I'm suggesting has any merit, one of the things that might happen to that kind of a set of questions is that we can reinfuse them with hope. One of the things that might happen to that set of questions is that we can start to think, okay, if that's the shape of the story, if the story is willing to put itself, if you want to use that sort of language, animate the story, if the story is willing to put itself through reboots as humanity's understanding of the world around it grows and changes and shifts, so that the presence of God can be accounted for, understood, worked with, lived with. And if we've got this entire text that just keeps behaving that way, and I think as we kind of go into this study, we're going to see that it does keep behaving that way. That just keeps going like that. How incredibly hopeful is that when we're living in the kind of age we're living in, where stuff is changing like nuts all the time? I just, out of curiosity, I kind of just did the Google, you know, what did I actually use for a search criteria? Top 10, because when you get a list, right? That's the way Google's brain works. Top 10 changes in the last decade, I think, or something like that. I just wanted to see what would happen. Instantly, I'm into a Newsweek.com series on the last decade and the magnitude of change. Like, right there. We are surrounded by the truth of this. We're surrounded by the truth of it societally. We're surrounded by the truth of it scientifically. We're surrounded by the truth of it monetarily. We're surrounded by the truth of it culturally. We just live in an age of intense, incredible change. Do you think our change is more intense and incredible than shift from being nomadic hunter-gatherer to being family unit, to being tribal unit, to being village, to being city-state, to being 21st century urbanite? Somehow, and I know I skipped some steps. Some of your education's way better than mine on that, and I didn't do it from my notes. The point is that change isn't new to humanity. What kind of a sacred text would we have if we had a sacred text that just ignored the fact that humanity changes, that societies shift? Now that'd be a text I would be inclined to dismiss as no longer having anything directly to say to me. But I don't think that's the kind of text that we have at all. And I think we've got good reason to believe that, contained within a pair of narratives that come in the first two chapters of the book. Massive reboot that happens before we turn the first pair of pages in most of our translations. That's awesome. If we believe that God has something to say to a 21st century person, if we wish to dismiss Christendom as historic and archaic, bad reading. Don't do it, because it'll mess with it. You know, you can't dismiss that kind of an arc, because it just punches out the end of the book and keeps on going. But that also means that it's our job to pay attention to the trajectory of the whole story and to discern and apply and test the implications of that now. In this century, in our life, in this culture. We don't get to hand that back to the story and say, as long as I do whatever it says here in black and white, I'll be doing what's good and right. We don't get to do that under this idea. We become responsible for the application of the arc of the story to our time. Damn. But there you go. This is the last thing I'll say today. I'm just going to shut up, except for singing. We're going to keep experimenting as a community. We're going to keep experimenting in this gathering. The shape of this gathering physically is not accidental. We're not as deliberate about it maybe as we wish we were sometimes. Sometimes we're just reacting. But other times we're really trying to be very deliberate about the changes that we make, the things that we fiddle with. They're all little ways. They're all little ways of trying to say that faith is meant to be embodied. That whatever we believe should change the way that we live, the way that we behave, the way that we move through time and space, the things that we do or don't do. The way that the world looks through our lens should affect the way that we behave in it. If this initial pair of stories is saying to us, among other things, that as we become more evolved human beings, one of the potentials is that the acuity, the sharpness of our moral lens can continue to grow, can continue to accrue. We can continue to parse more and more difficult things. And I know this can be a hubristic version of evolution. I get that. I get that we're not always getting better. And that sometimes when we look at ancient cultures, we just see them surpassing contemporary cultures in ways that are profoundly important. I understand that. So with that tension in mind, I'm going to continue with this thought just a little bit further. If there is the possibility that the moral lens can become sharper, clearer, or even that it can contain more possibilities, then if our sacred text is one that behaves in a way that comes back to the story and says, think of it this way, while you're wrestling with the implications of this growing group of things that you have to focus on when you're wrestling with good and evil. And remember that God can be understood in a way that doesn't put him outside of the compass of that. So whatever you're wrestling with that is difficult, that is painful, that is challenging, that is unclear when it comes to matters of right and wrong, these things do not need to be outside the compass of God. Because my Bible, for instance, doesn't talk to me about genetic engineering, does not mean that God has nothing to say to me about genetic engineering. Because the Bible does not talk to me in black and white narrative story form and cultured about different configurations of family that I see around me uniquely in the 21st century, it does not mean that those fall outside of the compass of God. I could keep going, but I'm just picking illustrations from around us in our culture and saying, no, actually, it's our job to take this story. Bring the God of that story as best we understand that God, and as we continue to grow to understand that God, because that's not done. The last page of the Bible does not give us the last word about who God is. It gives us a trajectory toward who God is. If we think it gives us the last word, we're one of the six guys with the elephant. That's why we started there. We're prattling about something we haven't seen. We're saying, oh, God is a lot like a snake. God is a lot like a tree trunk. God is a lot like a wall. We have a limited perspective. When we press into new terrain, we press into it with all the perspective that we can gather, but also knowing that there are things that we do not know, things that we do not see, things that we do not have all sewed up, and that needs to inform our humility and our search, but it can also inform our hope and our confidence in God. The vantage point that sees the whole elephant might not be ours, but that does not mean there is no being that has that vantage point. And if part of the trajectory of the story is that God is determined to reveal God's self to us in time and space in ways that change our life, that affect the way we understand and act out what's right and what's wrong, then we have every reason to hope that God will continue to reveal more and more of the elephant to us as we go along the way. We'll get closer and closer to actually seeing things the way they are. One of the things I love about that, and it is an Indian legend, which is also intriguing to me, because that's a culture in which that Indo-European understanding of God that's more general still thrives in a way that it doesn't in the West. One of the things that I find really hopeful about that bad poem is that the perspective of the six guys was way more complete than the perspective of any one of them. And to me, that is deeply consistent. To me as a Christian, as someone who believes in a Trinitarian God, that is deeply consistent with the idea of God as three persons and yet one. And that the shape of community is meant to echo that shape. That we actually need one another's perspectives
in order to have a fuller picture of the nature of reality, including the nature of right and wrong. All right. I said I'd quit. So I'm going to.
Every once in a while, I do feel badly for people who catch this in podcast and just have no context.
The end.